Diversity.
You have caused confusion.
Oh, trash is moron.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to my brand new show, Office Hours. I'm here with a McDonald's Twix latte, and it's bloody disgusting. Tried to give it to the missus, she didn't want it either. So there we are, strong start. Well, hello everyone. Hello. Now I'm going to be making a new channel introduction, and I thought as people are trickling in here, I might as well share some aspects of the new channel intro, kind of a behind the scenes look. That's you know, something that's in the making here. Let me just get that up. I'm going to get that up now. Everybody's just trickling in. Hello all. This is the Office Hours. Now, Office Hours obviously is named after the idea of a professor having office hours. And what we used to say is, you have to use it or lose it, use it or lose it. So the show will be as long as there are questions, right? So if there are only, like, say, 10 questions, the show will be 10 minutes. And if there are lots of questions, it can keep on going. Now, I'm just having a look to see if anybody sent any super thanks. And I have to be honest, I think some people did, but I can't find them. So that's a good start, isn't it? I remember seeing that somebody sent super thanks, but I don't know how to find those, which was part of my whole idea here, that people would send super thanks on the videos. I don't know where they come in. I don't know where you see them. I can't see them on my old kind of funding tab within YouTube here. A lot of the comments on the first week of videos has been about the intro. The intro was done by a very nice chap. I sent him a testimonial. I don't know if he wants to be named or not, but he did sterling work there. And what he said is that these intros are a placeholder, basically. He sees them evolving and changing over time. And the music, Karloff music, is a placeholder as well, because the time frame for the genius Chris Gard, who was roofing and couldn't find his muse, you know, he is going to come up with theme tunes essentially. So that music there is a bit of a placeholder until Gard comes up with something. But also, the chap who's making these intros has said that in time he wants basically each of the different types of videos to have their own intro based on this central theme of going through this house or library or something. So I think he did it pretty well. Anyway, as people are coming in, I might as well share this. Now, this is going to be a video in its own right, but I might as well share it here. This is my new channel intro, right? The contents of this video I'm going to make, the schedule, channel history, blah, blah, blah. I don't need to go into all of that with most of you guys. This will just be for people finding the channel. I have been finding that the videos have been attracting new viewers, people who literally just started watching in the past week or so. The Oasis video in particular seemed to, you know, be a generator for new subscribers. Who'd have thunk, eh? But this is basically the new schedule. I don't know why it's doing that. You know, obviously the E is on something to do with StreamYard's doing that. But 11 a.m. So the office hours stream 2 p.m. on Tuesdays. Deepest Law, me and Simon are looking at the 11 a.m. Wednesday slot, which seemed to work reasonably well last week. Although there was a large uptick in views when the Americans woke up, but can't be helped, I'm afraid. 11 a.m. Is the slot. And then I'm, at the minute, releasing the videos at 5 p.m. every day. Although there, for some reason, the Blair one from yesterday didn't do as, hasn't seemed to have done as well as the other videos. I actually have a theory as to why that is. It's because I had set it up as a premiere, and then I decided not to do the premieres anymore. And for whatever reason, that change had meant that people had already commented on the video. So I think it meant that nobody got a notification for that video yesterday, which a lot of people told me they did not get a one. So if you haven't seen yesterday's Blair video, watch one. At 5 p.m. today, so there's a hard get out for office hours. It means we have to be finished by 5 p.m. because the next video, today's video, will be out. And that is a bit of a classic Dark Lord watch, where following the release of his book, Blair did a ton of interviews. And it's me reviewing James O'Brien, who is an absolute state, in that interview with Blair, and also the one with Sophie Ridge. So it's a bit of a longer one. And in fact, as I've been making these videos, the length is creeping up on them. So a couple of the ones for next week or the week after are up to 45, 50 minutes. So, you know, they it really depends on the subject matter. I've been trying to keep them like 10, 20 minutes, but it's difficult when you're dealing with complex things. And I'll tell you what is forthcoming soon as well. I also made these arrows for no particular reason at all. And then I'm going to talk a bit about the history of the channel and how to catch up if you're new and stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. So that's a video that's going to be coming out. You know, it's just a new channel intro, which I have to make sporadically. The old channel intro, I might have had several old channel intros, and it'd be an interesting exercise for channel members to see if you can find those intros and go back and watch them all to see how the channel has changed over time. All right, so there we go. Yeah, I mean I'm just having a look at what I have lined up here, because one of the neat things about doing these videos every day as opposed to streams is that there's no, you know, I can work at a reasonably decent pace. So I'm seeing what's coming up, for example, because this is all, you know, all new for us, all a new way of being. So later this week, for example, I've got, so directly following office hours this week, there is How Does Tony Blair Embody Actually Existing Post-Liberalism? Okay. Then we have Wednesday, Why Is Winston Churchill So Important for the Regime? Thursday, What Was Behind the Recent Coup in Niger? Friday, and that's going to be a feature-length premiere, whole hour, hour plus. Why are the carry-on films an enduring part of British culture? And that's at 9 p.m. because it's I went to town on that video a little bit, and I'm hoping that will elicit the interest, at least of my British viewers, because the carry-on films are something else. Then next week, 50 minutes long, What Is Woke Imperialism? On Tuesday, Why Does Keir Starmer Hate Landlords? Wednesday, Why Did Donald Trump Point to Haitians Eating Dogs? Thursday, Russia versus NATO, unrestricted warfare, 46 minutes long. So you see how you see how it's you know, some of these videos are ballooning depending on what the topic is. It's difficult to discuss things like woke imperialism or Russia versus NATO as unrestricted warfare in 10 minutes. So that, you know, I have space to go on. I would say that anyway, that is what I've got forthcoming. I haven't decided what I'm going to do next Friday yet. I'm basically going to wait to see how the carry-on video does, and there could be further carry-on videos because I went to such town on that. I've got tons of material I didn't use, like loads of stuff I found out about these films, but I didn't have space to put it all in that one kind of documentary. So there could be, if it's popular, there could be smaller ones. Popular would be anything over 10K, I guess. So if the carry-on video does less than 10K, that'll be it, basically. But if it does more than 10K, you know, I may make some more. In terms of super thanks, I can't find any. That's not to say that nobody sent any, but I just can't find them. I don't know how to find them. Like the super thanks show in where this, yeah, look, your super chat and stickers activity. But where do I find the super thanks? That's no good, is it, YouTube? So I have no idea. If you sent a super thanks, you're going to have to tell me. Hey, I sent a super thanks. All right. So with all of that said, let's start taking some questions then. let's start taking some questions. And we could see this could be a nice short one or it could be a very long one. Let's have a look. O2 Tom says, what does a Trump second term act look like? I've said many times that I think a Trump second term would look a lot like Ronald Reagan, basically. I think he's shown every sign that he'll reign as Ronald Reagan. That said, he has been, you know, things have got a bit more real over in America. I mean, there's two assassination attempts now. You know, all of the trial nonsense, all of the craziness. So he could, you know, be hell bent on revenge and all the rest of it, but I'll believe it when I see it. I expect Trump to basically just be, I just think he's like a regular Republican at this point. You know, there's almost nothing in his platform that, I mean, apart from his emphasis on immigration at the minute, which is a very big plus, by the way, it's still all like low taxes and, you know, stop the communists and all that, as far as I can tell. And I honestly think Trump first term was, he was basically Reaganish then as well. So it remains to be seen whether that's the case, or indeed whether Trump will be the president at all. You know, many people think they're gonna, you know, fortify again. And judging by recent New York Times headlines, it does feel like, you know, at least some people are thinking about the fix being in again, as it were. But so I don't really know. I don't really know what's going to happen in America, to be honest. I think that it's obvious that the elites are split at the minute between where they want to go, what they want to do, whether they want to focus on Ukraine or Israel. It's another huge thing. There are certainly signs showing that there are elements in the regime that want to go for Harris again. Honestly, I think one of the things that changed the tone, because at one point I said, well, it's obvious the regime wants Trump's going to be the president, etc. is that when he picked JD Vance as the Veep, the regime didn't like that. And since then, things have changed a little bit, I think. They don't like Vance at all. And watching him, I mean, Vance is basically shitposting on a daily basis at the moment. And he's running to be the vice president, which is incredible to see, really. But yeah, so I think the Vance pick has changed the carcass a little bit for some people. Quite why, I'm not entirely sure why they hate him so much, but there we are. Khalifa K says, okay, well, I'm going to start at the beginning, sorry. I have to start at the bottom. TP says, imagine, so I don't know if I want, if you want any more on what the Trump second term, I mean, my honest answer is I don't know what a Trump second term will look like, but I feel like it will be, anybody expecting him to be radical, I think, will be disappointed. I honestly think that Trump has shown every sign, basically, of being a moderate centrist Republican, basically, which is what he is at this point. TP says, and the thing is with Trump is that a lot of his struggles become very personal and very kind of focused around him in particular. And his play is always to say, well, the reason they want to get me is because they're trying to get you, because I stand for your interests, I stand for you type thing. My honest feeling is that there's a way in which the Trump circus sucks all serious issues and turns it into something about him. And that's been my view for quite a long time now, that Trump is a very good way of it's a very distracting sideshow that takes people's focus away from anything that matters, really. Which is not to say that Trump can't do good, because he can. He does a lot of good. I think there's an honest, you know, this channel probably wouldn't exist without Trump. This audience wouldn't be here without Trump. So I'm not kind of showing discreditude towards him. He's done tremendous things. And in my video on Haiti, I'll explain, which is coming out later this week or next week. Next week, I think it's coming out. I'll explain, you know, basically all of the things that Trump does well, you know, the way he moves the needle on certain issues. He's a master at all of that. But there is a downside with it as well, which is that he's like a kind of black hole that sucks all the attention from everything. And he does have this habit of making everything about him personally, which that's going to be an issue whether Trump wins the election or loses the election. That's going to be an issue for the American right in the future, is a post-Trump world, a post-Trump environment, because so much is invested in him personally, and whether he wins or loses in 4 years' time, he's going to be gone. So what happened? I mean, that's probably the bigger question to ask if you're an American. What happens after him? All right, TP. On the other hand, if Kamala Harris does win, I think it's basically. I mean, I honestly, she's so awful that it's. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's the scenario that is more difficult to predict what will happen. It is in the Kamala presidency. My feeling is that, I mean, Harris is running as a centrist, believe it or not. She's dialed down. There's almost no wokery in her messaging. You know, she's presenting herself. Basically, she's running almost as a kind of left Republican, pretty much, you know, which is why she's getting these endorsements from Cheney and McCain and all these what's her name? Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney, who's the other one? Horrible I mean, there's about 200 of them, Republicans coming out for Harris. So, I mean, she's so, that shows that at least in her messaging, she can moderate. But whether she'll do that as president is another question, to be honest. And the, again, her VP pick of Waltz should be more concerning on that front. Now, in a free, fair, honest election, Harris is a jobber with no chance, as I've said many times. But I don't know, I'm starting to see signs that, you know, sensible adults in the room will not prevail yet again, given that New York Times headline I saw recently. All right, I think that'll do on that question. TP says, imagine if the Carry On series had continued long enough to enter the late 90s American Pie era of teen sex comedy with the same actors. Oh, God. That would have been a... That would have been a... in a way, we're blessed that that did not happen, because it would have been... watching like an 80-year-old Sid James leching at, you know, some of those actresses would have been... It's probably best that it finished when it did, to be honest, Carry On, which in my mind was 1978. I don't really think about Carry On Columbus. And as you'll see in the documentary, I basically ignore Carry On Columbus. Yeah. Cringewalker says, what are the odds for an actual limited or full nuclear exchange at this moment? Yeah, well, Russia's been on my mind a fair bit. Like I said, of those upcoming videos, the one on woke imperialism, but even more so the one on unrestricted warfare, are basically about the whole geopolitical situation at the moment. And I'm kind of concerned. He didn't sound like he was messing around, really, Putin. So, I mean, this goes back to the conversation that me and Panama Hat had at the event a couple of years back about whether nukes are real or not, and even if they are real, does it matter? Because is anybody ever going to use any, right? everybody is acting, and when I say everybody, I mean everybody in the West, everybody in NATO, is acting like nukes aren't real, right? Putin has come out and said a couple of times, remember, I've got nukes. It's like that. It's like Gandhi in Civilization. I am backed by nuclear weapons. And notably during the debate, the Harris-Trump debate, Trump mentioned, didn't he? Remember, Russia's got nukes. He said that. Nobody wants to talk about it. So I reckon that they are gambling on the fact that nobody is mad enough to actually use any. even though some of the rules around nukes have been broken. For example, we have seen Ukraine attack Russia within Russian territory now, right? With the Kursk offensive. we saw the Houthis and Iran at various times have direct strikes on Israel, who are a nuclear power. So the nuclear deterrent seems to have... and at the same time, we're seeing the West continually poke and go the Russian bear, even though its president is saying, I have got nukes. So... in a strange way, the nuclear deterrent is not being treated as serious anymore. When I was reading that book, Unrestricted Warfare, which is by two Chinese authors, it was written in 1999. I think my version of it was published by Vox Days Press. I could be wrong on that, but I think Vox Day has got his own book press, and I think they brought out their version of Unrestricted Warfare. And in that book, at one point they say, oh, well, you know, everybody's basically agreed that nuclear weapons are too big to use. So in their assessment, like they take nukes, they talk about, you know, they've got these essential principles in unrestricted warfare, and one of them is using unlimited measures to achieve limited ends, right? Limited objectives. And in this video that I have coming out next week, I basically do an assessment of how many of the essential principles are Russia doing at the moment and how many are the West, NATO doing, okay? And I keep score. And then at the end of the video, I declare, well, based on these principles, who's going to win this conflict, right? Because, you know, the whole idea of unrestricted warfare is that if you do all of those things, you put yourself in a good position to win. If you don't do any one of them, you're probably heading for a defeat, right? So I'm not going to reveal who I think is on top now, otherwise you guys won't watch the video. But anyway, as part of that assessment, they just mention in passing, it's like two lines. They say, oh, well, if the 20th century and the Cold War proved anything, it is that the use of atomic and nuclear weapons is too great a cost to pay, so we take those off the table. So at least in their thinking, which is state-of-the-art Chinese thinking from 20 years ago now at this point, but at least in their thinking, the nukes were just not a factor. It's like, yeah, you can use unlimited resources, but not nukes. They're just not on the table. So it's very hard to say. I honestly don't know, Cringe Walker. What I do know is that I have been looking at the Russia thing more and more in the past week or so, not just to make these videos, but because I am worried about finding ourselves in a war with Russia pretty soon, a hot war with Russia. Starmer went to Washington. Biden told him no. But the question remains, why did Starmer go to Washington? Boris Johnson came out the other day and he said, soon there is going to be a day when Ukraine are going to join NATO. I mean, I don't know if these people are all off their tree, if they're all mental, or they know that it's something that we don't know. Either way, they're still escalating at a time where they really should be de-escalating. And I'm worried about it. I'm especially worried about the prospect of Britain specifically being at war with Russia, with the Americans not actually being there. Now, I know there's this idea that an attack on NATO is an attack on all of NATO, right? But how can I put this? The Americans have played this in such a way where they've made the European powers the aggressors, and they're being the adults in the room. And, well, I mean, in war, treaties are nothing, right? Treaties mean nothing. In an actual war situation, what if America just says, yeah, okay, we're in this, but you guys carry the can on this. You guys use your own armies, and we'll just kind of provide support. What is anybody going to say or do in that scenario? I mean, NATO schmato, right? In the actual reality, somebody has to actually be engaged. And it feels like we're being set up. Britain is being set up for a situation where Britain is going to be the spearhead of this war. And I'm pretty concerned about it because, you know, I'm sitting in London here and these missiles can reach us, guys. So can you not start World War III? Anyway. O2 Tom says, Richard Tice is a man of destiny. Yes, well, Tice has actually become a little more based in recent times. And I'm actually thinking that turn on and manage Super Thanks. Hold on a minute. Yeah, I've got Super Thanks on. Super Thanks are on, but how do I see them? Oh, okay. All right, I have to filter the comments section to see the Super Thanks. I definitely saw a couple of them, and I just don't want anyone to think I'm diddling them by not answering their question. Let's have a look. Yeah, but I mean, Richard Tice seems to have, you know, he seems to be getting all the baselines now, and Farage has been a bit more anonymous for some reason. I don't know why that is, but I've got a feeling that they had a deal, Tice and Farage, that if Tice takes all the heat for the cuckery that he did, he then gets to be like the bad cop in their good cop bad cop duo going forward. And it really does seem like that's what's happened. I have to say that, I mean, as much as I have been critical and have disliked Tice in the past, when he gets angry, he's pretty, when he gets going, he can be quite savage, Tice. So, you know, he could come to be an asset in time, or somebody you can push the needle on certain issues. Overall, I remember a couple of weeks back, I got people on Twitter to give a score on how they think reform are doing, and what score you would give Farage. And on average, people were giving him 3 out of 5, 5 being the top job possible, 1 being rubbish. In fact, I might rerun that poll here to see how people are feeling about Farage now. Give a score to Farage. Let's see how people are feeling about Farage right now. So 5 is the top, 4, 3, and then we'll just say 2 or less, right? Less than or equal to 2. Less than 3, like that. Let's give a score. I'll actually do a poll, and we'll see how what score he gets. Okay, there's an actual poll there now. So let's see what people say. And let's take a sip of this cold Twix latte. Okay, but yeah, I mean, let's have a look how people are going on him. So far, only 6% of people, 5% of people have given Farage 5 out of 5, 12 4, 43% say 3, 39% say less than 3. So that's a rating of 1 or 2. So Nige, if you're watching, I mean, this is basically, you know, the viewers of this channel are going to be some of your core base, I'd imagine, and you're not being rated very well at the minute. He hasn't really stepped up since he's gone into Parliament, has he? And the fact that we're talking about Richard Tice probably shows you how anonymous Farage has been, really. I think he's been fairly disappointing myself. Didn't make the most of the riot situation. Got, you know, yeah, that one decent speech, but he's basically not. You see, one of the issues is that the Labour at the minute, Starmer, is doing stuff which is like neoliberal austerity, basically. And Farage, being essentially a Thatcherite, and the Tories being, you know, libertarians of one type or another, it's difficult for them to take advantage of that due to their ideological priors, basically. You know, it's easy enough for us to attack Labour for freezing pensions and so on. Much more difficult for, you know, a classical liberal to do it, because they're against state spending as an ideological thing. So, I mean, I don't think they are scoring the points that they should be against a very unpopular government. I mean, if Farage was playing things well, he should be the prime minister in waiting. And he's just not that, is he? At all. He's just nowhere at the minute. Okay. TP says, I understand your discussion of Catherine Austin Fitz was struck down, but what is her view of what the elite intend for us? Well, I don't want to keep on touting forthcoming videos, but on next Tuesday, Why Does Keir Starmer Hate Landlords is basically about this. It's got a clip from Catherine Austin Fitz in it, indeed. Cut a long story short, the elites are basically using every method possible at the moment to buy up land and assets, to take land and assets away from the kulaks, away from entrepreneurs who are not within the remit of their control, out of private hands and into the managerial octopus, basically. They want all of the properties to be corporate owned, under managerial control, whether it's BlackRock, multinational corporations, whether it's Bill Gates owning farms. They've got this push basically to, you know, I mean, I know it's a cliche to get towards the you'll own nothing and it will be and you'll be happy, but that is basically what Fitz is saying. And I'm just looking at the actions of Starmer, and I ask Canadians, and I still, if any Canadian is watching this show, one of the things I haven't talked about, because there are fewer guest spots on the channel now with the new structure, I've always liked to give people a chance to, especially lesser known names to, you know, get known and get an audience for themselves. If anybody wants to make guest videos, you know, I've got those 5 slots a week now. But one guest video I would love from a Canadian, any Canadian who could do this, or if you want to send me the material and I'll put the video together, but, you know, I need the actual stuff, is how many of the things Keir Starmer is doing now are policies that Justin Trudeau did in Canada. Because Starmer, in a very short space of time, is railroading through tons of stuff. You know, one of the policies that made me think this is that he's fast-tracking what they're calling assisted... What are they calling it? Not assisted suicide, assisted death. Assisted death? Well, what are they calling it, that thing? But basically, if you want to exit this world, the government will help you. Okay? Which is basically euthanasia by a different name, right? Now, I remember there was a big fuss when Trudeau did this in Canada. And now... Yeah, assisted death, that's what they're calling it. Made, right? Death by doctor, yeah. That made me think, hold on, Trudeau did that a couple of years back. And I'm wondering how many other things Trudeau did that Starmer has done. And what I would love is a video. I mean, if I have world enough and time, I'll look into it myself. But it would be wonderful for a Canadian to provide this for me. A list of all the things that Trudeau did, and now a list of all the things that Starmer has either done or is looking to do, and seeing how much of a match there is. Because, it's looking like... I mean, I don't want to sound like a kook or something here, but we're getting closer to 2030, friends. And we're on the timeline where they seem to be accelerating towards, you know, breathlessly trying to get all this stuff done. But for what purpose? Who wants this? Why? And everybody gets the sense that they're up to something, that they're really trying to race towards something they're trying to get to. And to me, the more I look at the actions of Starmer, I think about the actions of Trudeau and so on, and Schultz in Germany, that government in Germany has been just as bad. Lesser degree, but also Macron as well. And the actions of Biden in America too. Biden was accelerationist when he was in power. I don't know. I just think that we are heading towards the timeline where all of that stuff about, you know, 2030 and so on is happening. It's just happening, isn't it? They're doing it. people are making less of a noise about it now, and a lot of the kind of the pandemic conditions are no longer around, but they're still pursuing the agenda. Basically, they're still pursuing the agenda. So yeah, that's what my Landlord video is about. Because essentially, what Starmer wants to do is he wants to. What they are going to do, they're banning no-fault evictions, right? So imagine you own a house. You have people start to rent from you. But then you decide, oh, actually, I'd rather live in the house myself, or I don't want to take on tenants anymore. I want to leave it empty, or, you know, I have some other use for my own land. You're now no longer allowed just to kick the tenants out if they haven't done anything, right? So by law, the agreement that you signed, even if it's coming towards the end of its time, will tick over. It'll automatically renew. Basically removing the right for landlords to take people from their own property. This is terrible. Really terrible. And what it's going to lead to is normal people who own houses and act as landlords, you know, Mr. Jones, Mrs. Smith, whoever, selling up. And who will then end up with those properties? It will be large corporations, the housing associations, the Black Rocks of this world, etc. This is just achieving what Fitz talked about by different means in different places. And in different places, there'll be different enemies. So here it's private landlords. Kulaks. In the Netherlands, it was farmers. Kulaks. In Canada, it was truckers. Kulaks. So that's what I see everywhere. What Fitz talked about in the video that was taken down was BLM, basically attacking various sites. Imagine you're at Walmart or something, right? Walmart is big enough that its insurance covers all the damage that BLM did, right? But if you're a what they call a mom and pop store, again, Mr. Smith, Mrs. Jones, I don't know what in America, what would they be called? They'd be called like, people in America are called things like Chad Jones III and things like that. Hey, I'm Michael J.R. Chad Jones III. But anyway, the mom and pop stores that were hit by BLM, obviously some of them were driven out. They were driven out of business by it, or, you know, they had to sell up or whatever. And her idea was that the managerial machine would then buy up those properties for cheap. So that's what I'll be talking about in that video when it comes. Kind of alarming stuff, but it's all happening. Basically, the receipts are there, and they're kind of accelerating on it all, from what I can see. All out anarcho tyranny on every scale. It is, I think, I mean, it's just the ruling class and their client groups at war with the kulaks, you know, their potential rival castles, who, and then if you oppose them, they'll call you, they'll call you names. You know, oh, you don't really want your property bought up from under your feet, so therefore you're a Nazi or whatever, you know. On the American names front, does anybody know why they have that thing in America of like, hey, I'm Brad Davis Jr. III. Like, why do they do that? So many people in America have names like that. You know, they got the initials in the middle of their name. You know, Brad J. Davis Jr. III, and the junior bit and the third bit. What is all that about? People don't really do that here, but I've long noticed it's been a big thing over there. I seem to remember reading at one point that Americans by law have to have a middle name. Like it's legal requirement to have a middle name. And a lot of Americans don't, like, they just put a letter in there. So often the J or whatever it happens to be is just a letter. It doesn't actually stand for anything. Is that true? I read that once. That often the initial doesn't stand for anything. It's just because they have to fill out the form. Okay. That could be disinfo. I don't know. I can't remember. It was documentary or something, but it was mentioned to me once. Snell says, I've been listening since before Unpopular Opinions, and this is my first super chat. Well, Snell, thank you for your loyalty over the years, friend. Thanks for your first super chat. He says, do you personally think it's possible to have a based EU? If so, is England's destiny separate? Well, this is the Evola. This is, goes back to that Evola video made. Now, I must admit, the title to that video, which was Why Did Julius Evola Support the EU? Was a little bit clickbaity, to be honest, because Evola obviously did not support the European Union. And I think he was dead before it even existed, right? Evola, he died in the 70s, and the EU didn't really become a thing until later. He was talking about the unity of the two eagles, Germany and Italy, them basically forming the bulwark at the heart of Europe against America on the one hand and Russia on the other hand. Now, bear in mind, he wrote that in 1928 under Mussolini. And I think it was republished, that book, in 1932, 33, maybe even 34. So, you know, the mid-century Germans were already in, I think, by the time of the second edition of Pagan Imperialism. So he was talking about conditions as they stood back then. I mean, the Italy and Germany of today would be completely unrecognizable to him. Although he did basically predict in his works where they were heading. You know, a lot of his anti-American stuff is because he was watching Rome in the 50s, 60s, and 70s becoming Americanized before his eyes. So he knew where things were headed. So that's where Evola was coming from. Just to go off on a bit of a tangent before I come back to the EU. And to Evola, there's an interesting thing I've noticed in books written by Italians and Germans. I've got another book called How Europe Became American by Hans Vogel, who I believe is a German. And also in Pagan Imperialism, I didn't read it out in the video, but prefiguring that, there's a whole bit about how Italy and Germany are Western civilization. When you think of Western civilization, it's Italy and it's Germany, it's Rome and it's the Holy Roman Empire. It's, you know, like they've got this idea that the achievements of the West are basically German or Italian, okay? And Hans Vogel, in that book, How Europe Became American, has this whole, I mean, it kind of blew my mind. I don't want to do like, what Mark Brahman and Spencer would call petty nationalism here, but I did find it interesting because it really did make me realize how Anglo-centric my view of the world is, if you want to put it that way. Because this guy Hans Vogel, he basically says, like, look, the British take credit for inventing everything, okay? And it's true that most of us say, well, Britain invented the modern world. Everything around us, all the inventions, everything is down to a few geniuses in the 19th century. Some of them came from Scotland. Most of them were English, right? Some of them were Welsh, but it came from Britain. Britain invented the modern world. And that is very much something that most British patriots think. In fact, even some British leftists would think that, because that is the history that we have. And Hans Vogel basically in this book says, like, this isn't true. This is just kind of English arrogance, basically, to say this. And he goes through like dozens of inventions. He was like, yeah, this was German engineering. This was German. This was German. This was German. This was stolen by German. This was German and it was patented by that guy. This was stolen. You know, the American patented it, but the German invented it. You know, or sometimes when they're American, you'll say, well, actually, he was a German. He went to America in the 19th century. And it did kind of blow my mind. It did make me think, yeah, this is a very different view of history here. Because the other side of it, the other side of the Vogel argument, is that the argument goes that, well, Britain invented all these things because Britain had the Industrial Revolution, and Britain had the Industrial Revolution because of my free markets and because of my liberalism and because of my, you know, it's a libertarian argument, basically, at the end of the day, that the genius of individual enterprise, the free spirit of this piratical nation was unleashed upon the world. And, you know, so genius was born, right? We all know this story because it's the basic story we all have been told and have told ourselves our whole lives, okay? Up until wokery took root, in which case you inverse all of that. But, you know, the basic pro-British story is that. And this guy Hans Vogel was like, yeah, all of this is a lie. Almost everything is German of any worth. And these came from not the spirit of individual free enterprise, but from the kind of Prussian state-backed kind of Bismarckism and all of this sort of stuff. Or even in the eras before that, like the Germans are much more institutional, you know, even before you get to the unification of Germany, they had the guilds and the Habsburgs and all of that sort of stuff. And he's like, yeah, you know, all of this is kind of libertarian lies, this Vogel guy says. Actually, it comes from German managerial discipline, basically. So it's an interesting, I don't know what I think about it, but I do remember reading it and thinking, I have not encountered this attitude before, this kind of anti-English German exceptionalism, if you want to put it that way. You get a bit of it in Spengler as well. That's the only other place I've come across this. You know, if you read Spengler, Spengler doesn't like the Anglo mindset at all, and the kind of lies that Anglos tell themselves. There we go. It's just an interesting thing to consider. Anyway, to come back to the question as to whether there could be a based EU and whether England will have a separate destiny from that. I think there very easily could be a based EU, right? There's a situation, I mean, as I said in the video, you've got Maloney there, who has literally been talking to Keir Starmer this week about how to tackle immigration. AfD possibly coming in parts of Germany. I don't see those trends decelerating. I don't see any leftward shift in Germany or Italy in the coming future, because the support for the right wing parties is from the young, right? And if we know anything, young people don't get more left as they grow older; they get more right wing. So if you've got like the base youth voting now, you can basically count on them becoming more and more right wing as things progress and get worse. So I do see Italy, Germany, and France as well, who are strangely excluded from Evola's talk about the two eagles. I can't remember what Evola says about the French, but I think he says that they're always caught between their Catholic side and their Protestant side and stuff like that. But you'd have to go back and read. but, you know, those three countries, France, Germany and Italy, I can see them becoming more, quote unquote, based. Right. And if you then have a based EU, where does Britain stand in relation to that? The trouble is that let's pretend that you had a fully based Europe and a fully based Britain, right? I still think there's something in the English mentality, the British mentality overall, that sees themselves as being different from the continentals. It's not just language. There's something else. There's a different, how can I put it? There's a, that kind of German love of being part of the big organization, the big system. I don't think British people have got that. I think they do like their own little, I mean, these are cliches, but you know, the private castle, the private garden, wanting to be left alone and all of that. I do think those are deeply ingrained parts of the character of this nation, which is one of several reasons why Brexit happened in the first place. It's not the only reason. I also think there are American interests, certain American interests that promoted Brexit as well, or that were happy that Brexit happened. But in an ironic way, what Britain was doing in the EU was making it more woke. Britain was the one making the EU more liberal, more woke, more, feminist and all that sort of stuff. The argument was always that it was the EU imposing these things on Britain. But I think that if you really dig down into what, I mean, I have a video next week called Woke Imperialism, where a lot of this is discussed. I think you'll find Britain was always the liberalizing factor in Europe as a point man for America to impose American ideology on Europe. So in a way, Brexit happening gives Europe license to be more based, not less based, because you don't have the David Cameron in the room or the Tony Blair in the room anymore. I mean, that's my view, but I would say that because I voted Remain, didn't I? to be honest though, I don't see England's destiny as being tied to Europe's. It's that thing of being the island nation, the seafaring nation, the piratical nation, if you want to put it that way. It's not part of whatever it is the Germans are doing. And I don't think, I mean, it would be good for, if you want to think in terms of like the European race or something, it would be good if Britain was more of a team player in that sense, but it's not. It's not in its mindset is to want to impose its vision on everywhere else, not have an vision imposed on it from the outside, even if it's from Germany or France or something like that. Britain's never going to take that. It's always going to want to impose, you know, its view of the truth, whatever that is. At the moment, it happens to be woke. At other times in history, it was different visions, you know. I just don't think it's possible, you know, that there's a truth in that idea that in the national anthem of the Britons never wanting to be slaves type thing. Khalifa K, and you could ask, well, how come they take it from America then? But I think there's an extent to which a lot of British people just see America as an extension of itself. And a lot of Americans see Britain as the old country, they call it. But there's more of an affinity there, or at least there has been historically, than meets the eye. And this is especially seen when viewed through German or Italian eyes. When you read Italian writers like Evola or German writers like Vogel, how they view Britain and America always coming as a package and having the same values and being basically part of the same project. So unfortunately, I think that is a much more difficult knot to untangle. And I think anti-Americanism in this country is not very popular. It may have been at one point, but I don't think it is very popular. I'm interested that there is a growing literature drawing attention to American influence here. There's that one Vassal State. There's another one that came out with that left-wing press. In fact, if you bear with me, it came through the post. Oh, here it is. It's called Someone Else's Empire by Tom Stevenson. So there's that one. There's Vassal State. There's a few others that came out as well, where left-wing writers are basically asking a lot of the same questions that I've been asking that were highlighted in Oceans Apart, you know, the Adam Curtis documentary. And I'm interested by the fact the left is thinking along these lines, because that makes it more likely. I mean, there's a strange convergence between the stuff I've been saying and like what Aaron Bastani is covering on Navarra Media. And it's not just because of you could say shared blood between me and Bastani. I think there's something in the ether that people are kind of noticing. And since Brexit, it's been really obvious, I think, that Britain is America's point man in the world. So, yeah. All right, let's carry on. Yeah, but my answer is England's destiny is separate from Europe's. And in a way, I wish that wasn't the case. It would be easier if it wasn't the case, but it just is the case. And I kind of, I don't know, it swings and roundabouts, because I know that some people say things like, well, no more brother wars and things like this. But actually, the conflict of Europe, the fact that, you know, the English don't like the French and the French don't like the Germans and the Germans see themselves as the best and so on. That competition between the European nations was the engine room of what made Europe great. It wasn't the English and the Dutch and the Italians and so on all working together to conquer the world. They were actually competing with each other to conquer the world. And in a way, this is the tragedy of the two world wars. The two world wars have put the idea of conflict between the European nations out of the imagination. It's basically made it impossible to think of, imposed by the massive lesbian stiletto of America. But there's an argument to say that the historic greatness of Europe was in its competition between itself. Or at least it has been for the past 1,000 years. You can make different arguments, and this is where the pagan imperialism stuff comes in. You can make different arguments, as Evola does, that, well, there wasn't competition in Roman times, was there? There was just Rome. And Rome was great too, you know, so there's swings and roundabouts, different ways of thinking about it. But again, I tend towards believing that competition is a great engine room, which you could argue is a very Anglo attitude, couldn't you? You know, you don't get to choose where you were, how you're formed, I guess, where you're born. And this dictates how you think, I guess, or what your mentality is. All right. Khalifa K says, if you're a content creator, you can view super thanks messages from fans in the YouTube studio under the comments section. Yeah, but they're not separated out. I can't see any. Maybe nobody sent any, but AA is a sociopath. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Bronze Age Puritan, I am not a sociopath, sir. Why are you saying this? I'm not a sociopath. Academic agent, I just found your channel, but you do not miss 10 out of 10 takes. Well, thank you very much for that, sir. But these are just normal comments. They're not super chat, super thanks. These aren't super thanks. I don't know. I'm going to have to find out. If anybody sent any, you'll have to let me know. But it may be that you just hold your questions for this stream and ask them in super chat form, because these super thanks aren't, you know, I can't see any. I can't. And the trouble is I've got so many hundreds, thousands of comments that even if it was sent, it's like 5 days ago and they're not separated out. So yeah, back to the drawing board on that one. I am not a sociopath at all. I'm a very normal guy. Very normal guy. I'm a little bit antisocial. That is true. But sociopath, bit much, I think. Maximus Aquilus. Now, if I can finish this stream sooner rather than later, I can sneak one of these cigars. Several cigars here waiting to be smoked, and the sun is out. Can I do it, though? Let's have a look. Maximus Aquilus says, will you do an analysis of Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds? I love the story, despite H.G. Wells's degeneracy, and the music is top tier, in my opinion. The trouble with that is that the copyright is probably very hot on Jeff Wayne. My favorite part of that, of course, is the Richard Burton. Is Richard Burton's vocals on War of the Worlds. It's brilliant. I mean, I'm probably more likely to do something on Richard Burton, because being Welsh, of course, he's one of the people I really like. No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed that we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. Yet across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely they drew their plans against us. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, maybe did it in. It's a great album. Come on. Let's have a look. I consider it, but I think copyright would be an issue. For some reason, I see that album being like super, super blocky. You know, your video has been blocked worldwide. Oh, brilliant. I have to say, I give thanks to ITV, because I made the Carry On, the hour-long Carry On documentary thing. And I got all of these, your copyright. And I basically went through and appealed them all. But those ones were monetization. So I just said, look, this is a factual thing about British culture. I've only used a few clips type thing. And Studio Canal, who had the copyright, released them all, right? Literally within an hour, like, okay, your claim has been released. And like literally like 50 different copyrights were released all at once. I was like, brilliant. And then, like an hour later, ITV has blocked your video in the UK. It's like, fuck's sake. And so I did the same appeal, and then it took them 2 days. But fair play, ITV released that claim. So my Carry On video can be a rare victory, because most of the time, these bastards are like, no, our claim is still valid. Your video is still blocked. It's such a pain in the ass, those. So, yeah. Let's carry on. Coney says, I am liking the format, the new format so far. I think de-slopping my new feed and daily routine is definitely for the better. Also, Olivia Hootley from GB News has got some great sweater kittens. If you're not on Twitter, I've had one of those tweets that have gone a bit viral recently. You know what's really interesting when you have a tweet go viral? Is you notice that other accounts steal the tweet and then go viral with them themselves. Now, that's whenever I've had a tweet go viral, that has happened to me basically every single time. I'm not going to name any names, but it's been noted. I see. I know your games. Maybe that's why they're big accounts, because they just steal anything that trends. They're like, right, I'm just going to make the same tweet. Yeah, I'll show you the one I'm talking about. And it's kind of depressing because you have all the, you know, all of the time that you spend making stuff and doing things. But the thing that gets the most views this week was this tweet that I made. yeah, it's this girl here on GB News. And I even had a bit of carry on fun with it because I made a look, I made the reaction clip to it as well. That would be that has inspired a video, by the way, that I may make. I don't know if I'm going to make it yet. I remember years ago, I read a book called The Male Gaze by Laura Mulvey, and it's made me realize that there's no such thing as the female gaze. There's only the male gaze, basically. You just saw it. I thought it'd be interesting to revisit her arguments in that book, because I remember her talking about how the structures of plot are patriarchal. That is, the adventurer, the hero, has a quest, okay, and he needs to overcome some challenge and reach the Holy Grail, for example. You know, standard quest narrative of a male hero. And Mulvey argues that this is basically like a masculine form, which subjugates women, puts them into the role of the damsel in distress or whatever. And it perpetuates this male gaze that she's talking about. And I'm kind of interested in this idea, because I think attempts to, or feminists to overcome this essential problem that Mulvey talks about, are destined to failure. There's a reason why plot has this particular structure. There's a reason for it. It's actually really difficult to take away the elements that Mulvey talks about. You don't really have a story. You don't have drama without conflict, basically. And you can't have plot, which is only process. And this basically, you know, if you ever read any gender psychology stuff, not ones written by feminists, I mean, ones written by serious people, there's a consistent pattern of male psychology being goal-oriented, and female psychology being process-oriented, right? Of men talking to convey a message, and women talking for the process of talking, right? This is not like misogyny or stereotypes. This is just actually true of what men and women are like. It may go back to hunters versus gatherers or something like this. I don't know. I'm not an Evo psych guy, right? But that may be the reason. Ask JF or Dutton or whatever. But that puts women at a disadvantage when it comes to narrative, because it's much easier to tell a story about trying to retrieve the object or overcome the obstacle to fetch the quest. You know, I've got the sword, I've killed the dragon, I've got the Holy Grail, than it is to tell a story about process, right? So that there's an inherent advantage, and so what you then end up with is putting women in masculine roles, right, which is Katniss Evergreen or Rey from Star Wars or whatever. But they're not actually overcoming the patriarchal structure when they do that. They're just saying, okay, well, women can be put into the masculine role. Right? So they're not really defeating anything. They're just kind of doing the same thing, but worse. So I'm kind of interested in that. So I might do something on it at some point. Anyway, yeah, that was Olivia Utley. And I'm glad, Coney, that you're enjoying the new format. Is anybody else enjoying the new format? Press one if you're enjoying the new format. If you're not, there's nothing I can do, I'm afraid, because this is the new format. But, you know, welcome aboard to those of you who are enjoying the new format. Beale Schrodinger says, what are your thoughts on Agamben's ideas and his use of Schmidt's ideas? I'm afraid I'm not familiar with Agamben. Who is this character? Who is Agamben? I will have to have a look. Agamben, State of Exception. He's an Italian philosopher. He looks a lot like that guy who goes on Judge Knapp, Crook. Alistair. He looks a lot like Alistair Crook, Agamben. Agamben. I'm not familiar with this chap, I'm afraid. No, I've not read any of him. He sounds pretty left-wing from his Wikipedia description, but that's something that I must explore. What would you recommend, Beale? What of Agamben's would you recommend me check out? John Lister says, sorry for off-topic. Could you give a definition of the term managerialism and then explain why exactly it is undesirable? What? Alexa, stop. I wonder what set Alexa off there. Anyway, so something about that super chat set off Alexa. Yeah, I mean, well, for my full definition of managerialism, you should read the chapter on James Burnham in The Populist Delusion. Or you can watch my video retrospective on managerialism, which is about 2 hours long. You'll find it in the archive somewhere. It's, I think, retrospective part 11, if I had to remember correctly. But it's called On Managerialism, which has got all my videos that I did on managerialism back in the day. But a very short definition is a group of technical, they can be technical experts or they can be more general managers, bureaucrats, if you want to put it that way, making decisions on behalf of everybody else. This is basically managerialism. And the reason that it's different from older forms of liberalism is that back in the kind of 19th century version of liberalism, you had industrialists owning, you know, the factory owner, the industrialist owning property and taking most of the decisions. The example I use in Populist Delusion is Henry Ford, right? Henry Ford. Henry Ford was the founder of the company. Or if you want to use a modern example, Elon Musk. Right. Elon Musk is the owner of his company and he takes the decisions and what he says matters. Yeah, under managerialism, the owner of the company matters a lot less because most of the practical decisions are taken by a coterie of managers, hired managers, the CEO as a manager. Now managerialism is basically a system in which this strata of manager basically comes to preoccupy all of the key positions in society. Okay. So it's easy to see when it's business, when it's Henry Ford versus, I don't know, Michael Eisner or something, right? I can't remember who the actual CEO of Ford is, right? But it's a manager. Even now, if it's a member of the Ford family, that member of the Ford family has gone to Harvard or Yale and got an MBA. So they're a trained manager. They're not a man like Henry Ford, who was basically the dictator of his company as the owner entrepreneur. Okay. You can see it easily in business. It's much less easy to see in other walks of life. But it should be obvious once you do see it. For example, politicians are also just managers. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is like the CEO manager of the company. And Tony Blair has just written this book on leadership. And in the video that I have premiering, being published in about an hour or so, you'll see he talks several times about there being no essential difference between the CEO of a company and the Prime Minister of the UK. Okay, so the Prime Minister is seen as a managerial role and a managerialism. And you can actually see, like, Nick Clegg, who went from being the Deputy Prime Minister under David Cameron to being an executive at Facebook. And that move was just seen as being lateral and easy. Okay, but now think about a modern day university. Now, universities used to be the domain of the academic and the professor, but academia has become increasingly managerialized to the point where now the top positions, the management positions, are taken over by people who could have been running companies. So the CEO of the company and the vice chancellor of a university and, let's say, a cabinet position are seen as being three different types of managerial position, and the same person could occupy any one of them. Nick Clegg, for example, after he leaves Facebook, it wouldn't be out of the question for Nick Clegg then to become, I don't know, the vice chancellor of Leeds University, for example, and for these roles to be seen as interchangeable. Okay, let's think of another domain, the army. Now, once upon a time, a military man was a military man who thought like a soldier, right? He had a different way of being because he was an army man, okay? Now, the top generals in the army are managers. They're pencil pushers. They are of the same stripe, basically, as Tony Blair or the CEO of a major company or as Nick Clegg. So managerialism is not just the factor of having managers, right? Because even under old capitalism, Henry Ford would have had foremen and managers in his factories and so on. It is the management function being the actual ruling class, and this class coming to predominate over all areas of life. And you can pick any example, like the medical profession, for example. Once upon a time, that was the domain of doctors and nurses. You know, you go back and watch Carry On Doctor or something, and it's a different world. But under managerialism, the management function comes to predominate over all those other functions. So it's not it is some manager running the show now in the NHS. Not the doctors, right? I mean, even in cases where GPs end up running their own surgeries and so on, even then, the actual functioning of that particular clinic or whatever ends up becoming managerial because we're in this intensely managerial system. As to whether it's desirable or undesirable, in James Burnham's analysis, it is basically a function of mass and scale, that after a certain degree of mass and scale, certain degree of size, it basically becomes impossible to run things in the old entrepreneurial executive way, that you know, the need for managers actually there's basically a need for the management function, which then centralizes power in the manager, which makes the process of managerialism almost inevitable in Burnham's analysis. Why is it undesirable? My main reason for this is, John, that the trouble with the management function is that it has misaligned incentives with whatever it is you're trying to do. Okay, the incentive of the manager is always to enlarge the remit of their own power, enlarge the remit of their own budget. Okay, it's seldom ever to actually solve the problem. So under managerialism, you end up with a strange incentive structure whereby the system almost needs invisible problems that then justify the budgets of various management functions. I mean, you might think about climate change or the war on drugs or the war on terror or any of the other invisible problems that we are accustomed to facing, okay? But what is the cause for all of these calamitous things? Like, what is the reason for them existing? It is for some management, for some manager in the internal function to justify a larger budget for themselves. I mean, I've said this on a number of interviews before, but the example I always remember is the welfare team on campus, okay? Now, I remember being in a meeting where there was a stat given, 78% of students on campus suffer from anxiety. Therefore, this was the implication, therefore, more budget needs to be given to the welfare team, right? And more resources need to be given to the welfare team or the well-being team, whatever the fuck they call it. And I remember being in that meeting and saying, like, doesn't this statistic show that that team has failed? So how are you rewarding them with greater budget? At what point does the well-being team get judged against that stat? Why aren't they bringing it down? That is not how managerialism thinks. Managerialism says the problem keeps on getting bigger, therefore keep on enlarging our budget. I remember Thomas Sowell talking about this when he worked in the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics or whatever it is, right at the start of his career. And, you know, after a certain point, he figured out that nobody in any of those functions was actually trying to solve the problem. None of them were. Because that is not the business of managerialism. And that's why it's undesirable. Because managerialism is essentially parasitic. It doesn't solve the issue 9 times out of 10. Whereas entrepreneurs, by their very nature, are problem solvers. Engineers are problem solvers. The people who built British Empire basically are all people who will actually solve problems. Managers don't solve problems. They often exacerbate them and make them worse to justify expanding their own power, because their incentive is never to actually solve the problem. I hope that makes sense. Does that make sense to you? It's a little bit of an intractable problem, though, because there is actually a need for the management function, right? So the 64 million, or in these days, billion or $64 trillion question is, how do you have the management function without the management function taking over, right? And I would say that that is a much more difficult thing. That would involve somebody like Elon Musk and all of the people like Elon Musk understanding this as an intractable problem, and then almost like Robert Conquest's second law, you know, you'd have to say, like, any organization that is not explicitly anti-managerial will become managerial over time, right? I would say that is basically a kind of iron law, because they're the organized minority, right? Burnham's idea is pure elite theory, because it's the organized minority in the organization. And of course, that organized minority over time will accrue more and more power to itself. Okay, almost like you know, and it will eliminate its rival castles within the organization, and that's how it takes over. Okay. So you'd need an extremely alert set of entrepreneurs like Elon Musk to be like, we're not going to let this happen. We are always going to empower the engineer, the problem solver, the software guy, the actual people who can do these jobs. And we're going to be like, we're not even going to have an HR department or whatever, or we're going to have like the bare minimum of what it could be. And we're going to make the KPIs of that all geared against the natural incentives of managerialism to grow their remit. But that requires everybody being switched on all the time. So it seems like a bit of a fantasy to me as to how you actually stop it. Okay. So yeah, it is a bit of a catch 22 because you do actually, and when you read Robert Michel's in On Parties, he actually lays out really well why the management function is actually required, as does Burnham. So it is a tricky one. TP says the Russians allegedly have placed tsunami, creating nukes on a bed of the North Sea, according to Simon Roche of the Siouxlanders. I am not familiar with Simon Roche of the Siouxlanders. What do you mean a tsunami creating nukes on the bed of the North Sea? That doesn't make any sense. A tsunami? What do you mean by a tsunami creating nukes under the sea? Doesn't sound right. Dan, Qua111, says, everyone talks about how self-serving she is, but Tice's woman put a lot on the line when she released the Hancock WhatsApps, and she doesn't get credit. I didn't even realize that was Tice's missus, to be honest. I didn't even know that. Cringewalker says, I have noticed that many polls at doing bizarre methodology this year, like only polling their paid readers or their online forum. You did a good review on some of these author methods, but can you do more? Well, you see, the thing is, Cringewalker, the point of that video was not only that company, Active Poll or whatever they're called, uses awful methodology. It is that their methodology basically doesn't tally with the other polls, right? I know everybody says, oh, well, 538 does the poll of polls, okay? But that doesn't explain how these different pollsters using wildly different methodology end up with the same numbers. Because if the first poll was right, the second poll would have Trump winning by a mile. But the second poll used very different methodology and came up with the same numbers. So how does that work then? Again, this subtle point, I expect nobody to, you know, I mean, that's probably why they do it, right? And I'm not saying that all of these pollsters are deliberately in kind of concert or in a conspiracy with each other, right? I'm just saying that it just so happens that all their various methodologies come up with the same numbers. That active poll had a 1.5 weighting on Republicans. The second poll I looked at weighted them equally, and they came out with the same numbers. I'm calling bullshit. Smoking Snowman said, dear AA, are you aware of the World 3 model and the Club of Rome? If so, do you see any connections between the current policies and its predictions? I'm afraid, Snowman, I am not aware of these things. I could look into them, but I have not researched these. To be honest, it has the whiff of kookery about it, but that is not to say that it's untrue. So there we are. Whenever things get a bit secret society, I always think, well, you know, the trouble I have with so much of that stuff is that it's all predicated on this world that is still run by essentially like 19th century Britain, right? And it's like, look, you may think that, but look at the actual reality of this world that we're living in right now. Well, we have to go back to, you know, oh, look at this secret society in 1870 and all of this sort of stuff. And they end up making extremely spurious links to try to make these argument works from the starting premise that the world is run by the secret organization that existed in the 19th century. Whereas I'm just like, well, why don't we just look at the actual people who are here right now that we can see? Because they tell us what they're going to do. Now, it could well be that Justin Trudeau is a member of the Club of Rome or whatever, but do we need that? If you can prove it, great, but do we need that step? So that's why I have a natural skepticism on that sort of thinking. Benjamin Rood says, just popping in to say hello. Well, hello, Benjamin. I'm glad that you could make it. Hopefully you've been enjoying the new format. DC said, hi, you talk about the elites, but who are they? What individuals? And how are they organized across two distinct UK political parties, for example? Well, I've got a video on the channel called Who Are the Elites, where I go through the various different theories on who they are. But the thing is that sometimes they don't need to be directly organized. They can just have their incentives laid out before them, or their constraints laid out before them. This was the genius of Blair, right? The Blair made the Tory party Blairite without ever having direct control over the Tory party. He just changed the incentives and the constraints, and the rest worked by themselves. Okay. Now, this is not an emergent phenomenon, because it has been deliberately set up by an organized minority. But some part of it works by itself as well. Much more mysterious to me is, how is it that both political parties, for example, are absolutely hell-bent on war with Russia, on supporting Ukraine? And anybody who dissents on that front is immediately purged and destroyed. Corbyn was destroyed because of his foreign policy views. You know, anybody like the time where Farage has had the most fierce attacks on him is when he mentioned Ukraine, when he broke ranks with the foreign policy establishment. And that, how that mechanism works and what the actual direct kind of communication channels are, I don't know. You'd have to be a true insider to know how that piece of it works. But it's like magic, isn't it? Every single person who's anywhere near power has got the exact same foreign policy, whether it's Britain or Germany or France or Italy or America. Isn't it magic how that works? And the one guy who doesn't have the same foreign policy, Donald Trump, you know, they're hell-bent to destroy him, call him Hitler, shoot him, etc., etc. Weird how that works, isn't it? So I do think that the foreign policy piece is the heart of the beast in many ways. That is the area where you are just not allowed to dissent. You know, look at Meloni, right? She was allowed to be an all-out fascist. The press called her a fascist. And yet she was still allowed to become the Prime Minister of Italy because she gave them the foreign policy piece. Isn't that remarkable? That's the thing that the regime cares about more than anything else. Next week, I have a video called Woke Imperialism, which goes into this a little bit as well. I would love to know. And you see, if I ever got to sit down with people like Blair and so on, these are the sorts of questions I'd ask him. What is the mechanism to make everybody in those positions have exactly the same views on foreign policy? And also, why is it that anybody who diverges gets destroyed? So, TP says, I'm a heritage American, Brad Todd Jr., the ninth senior. The ninth, TP? I think TP is messing around. You're not really called Brad Todd Jr., the ninth. I also seldom see, by the way, the Roman numerals ever go beyond the third, right? You often see Americans called something something the third, never the fourth or the fifth. It always stops by the third. Why is that? I'd love to know. This is a question for a demographer or, you know, someone who's into anthropology or something. They'd have to. Oh, some people do know a fourth. Okay. I often only see it stop at the third, though. Redacted Brainwave says, I've been watching under different accounts since the days of the econ lessons. I frequently purge the slop out of my timeline by creating a new YouTube account. Cheers. Well, I mean, if you only subscribe to me, you'd have a perfectly non-slop timeline. unfortunately, it's very difficult to have a non, like even my timeline is just absolutely chock-a-block full of slop. It's very difficult because we live in many ways in the slop world. But I find myself kind of mentally just scrolling past it all. Clearly, I'm in the massive minority, though. I feel like people tend to click on slop and scroll past anti-slop, and the numbers on that speak for themselves. But, you know, I'm bravely going out against the herd, as I always do. Goni says, imagine one of us going the Palpatine route in the EU, working themselves up the ladder to become EU president, creating an EU army, and using said army to declare themselves Emperor of Europe. Well, I know one man who definitely did have that as a plan, Coney, and that was destroyed by Brexit, wasn't it? That man was Tony Blair, and that is one of the things he's most bitter about. Everybody knows that. Blair wanted to become the president of Europe, and Brexit stopped him, and he is fucking pissed about it. Redacted said, AA, would you entertain making a video on Oswald Mosley? In a previous stream, you mentioned you were not familiar with him, which I found surprising. Unfortunately, Redacted, I would not make a video on Oswald Mosley, because making such a video in Keir Starmer's Britain is liable to land you up in jail. So I'm not going to do that because I've got responsibilities and so on. I'm sure he's a fascinating figure in his own right. The bit about Mosley that I'm most interested in, actually, is his views on economics. He had particularly radical views on economic solutions around that time, which were quite different from what other people were saying. That's something that I am kind of interested in, but... unfortunately, the Mosley is considered a toxic figure by the mainstream. And, you know, making a video like that would be a gift to our enemies. Mulatto Ultra says, friend, the Golden One says, he regrets not telling friends to get into politics. What are your thoughts? I watched that video by the Golden One. Well, I started watching it and then I got distracted and never finished watching it. But, I mean... I would say if you get involved in politics at all, I would get involved at a local level. I would reiterate what I said at the event a couple of weeks ago. You've got to tune out the clown show as much as possible and to take over your local council, basically, because that is the tangible thing that you can do that is in your control. What is not in your control is the shape of national politics, the incentives and constraints behind it, and more importantly, the biggest barrier to entry is the money element. So you have to consider national politics as being controlled by the enemy. Local politics would be the thing to get involved in if you get involved in anything at all. Blood and Rain says, I didn't get to listen to the final UO. So thank you for introducing me to political theory during a time I was taking care of my wife while bedridden. Well, I'm glad the show was helpful to you, Blood and Rain. I mean, all of the UOs now and Cigar Stream are behind the paywall. You can get access to them all if you join the channel, as many hundreds, many thousands of people have done. You too can join that crew. Von here says, I saw E.T. for the first time recently. You pretty much ruined it for me. The messaging was suffocating. It was hard talking to a leftist friend about it. I mean, I guarantee you, if you watch any Steven Spielberg movie, knowing the things that we know, they're all terrible apart from Duel. Spielberg made one good film, Duel, and all of the others are just revolting propaganda, barely concealed, naked contempt for his audience, Spielberg. In a way, there's a kind of baseness about it, but I really don't like Spielberg. Donna Murphy says, or rank punditry, but Mario Draghi published a report declaring the EU is buggered and needs to share debts to save the German auto industry. Disgraceful. On Italian news, I saw that Salvini is facing jail for wanting to stop that migrant boat a while back. Is that true? I mean, if they jail Salvini for trying to enforce the law, that would be a level of stupidity that, you know, we haven't seen before from the regime. But as per whether the EU is buggered, I would believe it. Europe is in dire straits, and much of it is self-induced, right? Much of it is self-induced or America-imposed, whichever way you want to look at it. But you could argue it's self-induced because the leaders of those countries didn't have to go along with the Americans, when it came to Nord Stream and basically the kind of sabotage that they've done to their own economies over Ukraine. I have a video. I mean, sorry to keep on mentioning future videos I have coming out, but it's relevant. I've got a video on Niger coming out on Thursday. It's called What Was Behind the Coup in Niger, right? Now, in the media, that was framed as being like anti-colonial and to do with, you know, getting rid of French power and all of that. Actually, the real story was to do with the energy security of Europe. That's the hidden story behind Niger, because they were going to stick a pipeline through there from Nigeria up into the EU. And somebody, Putin, has fucking wrecked that. So Europe is in a difficult situation because basically they've tried to fuck with a bear and the bear is fucking them back. It's absolutely suicidal, stupid. The Americans don't care. The Americans have fucked over Europe. You know, they've got what they wanted out of Ukraine. They can bugger off now, which they will do probably. But Europe is buggered. Really is. Germany especially, absolutely buggered. Daniel Marston says, is Blair's new book worth getting, or is it that just the prints updated for modern audiences? I think it is worth getting because there's lots of bits in there where he reveals, in a way, current elite thinking, which is, as I said in the video yesterday, strikingly non-democratic and not very liberal either in many places. There are other parts where he is more kind of liberal and progressive. I mean, it's Blair, of course he's going to be. But I was surprised, actually, just how mask off he is a lot of the time. I mean, he basically says at one point, public opinion doesn't matter. I mean, it's extraordinary. In those interviews, in the video I have coming up later on, he's like, frankly, yeah, I do know better than you. I've talked to the experts and yes, we know better. I mean, in a way, based, but in another way, it's kind of like, fucking hell, you're going for it, Blair. He just doesn't give a shit anymore. Blair doesn't. He's just full on, all out mask off at the minute. Redacted Brainwave says, could the recent events in Southeast Asia, coups, etc., be signs of the regime gearing up for a China war, a Cold War between China and the US? I think that we're already in a Cold War, veering on a hot war. And the two sides in the Cold War are very obvious. It is the West, the collective West, as the Duran like to say, plus, you know, that's Europe, America, plus friends like Japan, Australia, etc., versus Russia, China, Iran, plus their friends. And their circle of friends is getting bigger, and our circle of friends is getting smaller. That is why I made that video on Bangladesh last week, right? Because that was basically a direct strike on Indian power by America. Okay. Now, in our minds, India are part of the collective West, right? Or they are allies of ours or something. But that's just not the case. The Indians are getting really close to the Russians, and bizarrely getting close to the Chinese. You know, they're a bit more, they're less completely on side than some of the other countries, but these are like concerning developments, I would say. And my honest view is that the problem is with our leaders is that they're fucking delusional, right? Boris coming out and saying, oh yeah, Ukraine are going to join NATO, it's inevitable, is he's off his fucking tree. And the problem is that our leaders in America and in Europe are so used to having the run of the rule of the roost since the fall of the Berlin Wall, right? Since the end of the last Cold War, they're so used to having their own way that they simply cannot accept that anybody else has a will, anybody else has any agency, anybody else has any interests or agendas that are not dictated by them. And it's pissing off the entire world. And the entire world is saying, actually, fuck off. No, you don't get to do this anymore. You're not going to tell us what to do anymore. Especially not when the thing you're telling us what to do is allow people to bum each other with impunity or whatever else woke bollocks they're trying to impose on all the countries of the world. This is a serious issue. And I am increasingly of the view that arguments from people who support NATO and so on, that this is not happening or the BRICS is a paper tiger and all this, is all bollocks, because this is happening. I think this is happening, and people are just delusional and refusing to come to terms with the reality of it. When people say that to me, oh, it's a bit, they're buying into the delusions of our leaders right now, who just refuse to accept the new reality that we're not living in 1996. And they can't accept it. They just don't. And this is why I'm worried about the genuine prospect of this escalating into an all-out conflict. Because they are out of their tree. Our leaders are. They just won't face facts at all. It's like they're possessed, or it's like they just cannot, even if they were shown, they wouldn't be able to see it. My view is they need to be replaced, the whole bloody lot of them. Where is he? Come on, it's a new show. Where is he? Where are you?
Clear them out. Clear out. Clear them out. You've got to clear them out. You've got to clear them out as well. There needs to be a new start.
Honestly, they're going to get us all killed. They really are. Bromham Hank says, managerialism is failing, and failing is undesirable. Well, exactly. Yeah, that's another way of putting it. All right, I think that's it. Oh, no. There is more. There's more. Lurker says, hello, Lurker. Lurker says, hey, AA, I'm a season one on Popper Opinions and Cigar Stream Enjoyer on a fresh account. I'm looking forward to this new direction of the channel. Well, thank you very much, Lurker. I'm glad of your long-term support, and I hope you continue watching me as we march bravely into this new era. Now, on future editions of Office Hours, I hope to welcome friends, you know, all of the big family of friends, even D if he's ever up, which is unlikely, to be honest, but you know, anybody who came on the old shows is welcome to tag team with me on these shows. If nothing else, to give my voice a rest, because solo streams are more difficult than solo videos. So hopefully, you know, there'll be more people coming in. You know, I just thought I better do the first one on my own to signal, because I felt like if I just had a full panel, people would be like, oh, this is just UO again. And it's not. It really isn't. I'm trying to make it its own thing. TP says, and also I don't want to really have a panel. I think maybe one guest to you know, just to have somebody to chat to would be cool. TP says, imagine, so we did that. I think that was the only super chat I missed, unless I'm mistaken. I'm really glad that guy hated ET, by the way. I hate ET as well. All right. That'll do. We are finished. That means I get to have a cigar, friends. Let's have a look what's in my box today. I've got my little travel box because I'm not at the lodge. I'm at home. What have I got here? We've got Hoyo Epicure Especial. We've got a Romeo Giulietta Mille Fleurs. We have H. Upman Connoisseur 1. We've got an H. Upman Corona Major. We have a Fonseca Cossacos. And we've got H. Upman Majestic. Well, I don't really have enough time to have. I'm going to go for a cheap and cheerful. Let's go for the, let's go for the Corona Major. I've been enjoying those recently. I'm going to go for the Corona Major. That's a very tasty cigar. So I'm going to spark that up outside while the sun is still out and while it's not raining. Rarity. Hopefully you all enjoyed the first office hours. 5 o'clock, my new video drops. I want to see those numbers pumped up because the numbers have been decent, to be honest, but I was unhappy with the numbers on the Blair one from yesterday. So I want the numbers on one today to be way up. And I will see you all tomorrow for Adam Curtis review with Simon Roberts. And Sam 153 has just come in right at the end, says, congratulations on New Beginnings AA and looking forward to it. Well, thank you very much, Sam 153. It means so much. But most importantly of all, friends, it's time to get out.
Away with you, beggar! Away with you, beggar! Away with you, beggar!